From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Auburn faces Oregon in Monday's BCS title match. Ahead in Only a Game, a preview of Tigers versus Ducks. Maybe we'll do a web feature, too. Get it? Ducks? Web feature? Also, a look at this weekend's NFL wildcard games, and renowned numbers cruncher Nate Silver shares his list of the 10 worst playoff teams of all time, including the 7-9 but oddly playoff-bound Seattle Seahawks. Also ahead, old-time strongmen convene to flaunt their strength and celebrate legendary predecessors like the mighty Adam.
He would put a chain in his mouth and just chew it in half. To me, that was the greatest thing he ever did.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In NFL playoff action, today's afternoon game will find the New Orleans Saints facing the 7-9 Seattle Seahawks. Much more about the less-than-spectacularly qualified Seahawks a little bit later. And the Indianapolis Colts will play those tabloid delights, the New York Jets. Wide receiver Reggie Wayne is one Colt who's undismayed about how close his team came to missing the postseason altogether.
They all the same, man. Just, no matter how you get in, as long as you get in, you know, be thankful we can kind of take care of our first goal, and that's to win a division. And we was able to do that, so now we're in. Oh, now everybody's the same score, you know, same record, and it's a new football now.
It's a new football for the Jets, too, and probably they couldn't be happier about that, since the team has recently been hit with a couple of lawsuits based on the alleged sexual harassment of a couple of masseuses they used to employ by a quarterback they used to employ, Brett Favre, and a whopping fine because a few weeks ago their strength coach decided to participate in the game by tripping an opposing player as he ran by. In tomorrow's action, the Philadelphia Eagles will host the Green Bay Packers. Michael Bradley, a columnist for Philadelphia Magazine's website, maintains that in this case, the home field advantage should not be exaggerated.
The fans will be in full froth, and it will be a home field advantage. But nothing so much that the Packers are going to be saying, oh my goodness, we don't stand a chance.
Based on historical precedent, Bradley figures Eagles quarterback Michael Vick and his teammates better start strong in tomorrow's game, since their fans have been known to be short on patience.
Philadelphia fans are Machiavellian. If you reward them with success, they will give you the benefit of the doubt. If you do not, I don't care if you're a choir boy, altar boy, and candidate for sainthood, they will find something, some reason not to like you.
Since both the Eagles and the Steelers are in the playoffs this time around, it seemed natural to wonder if fans in Philadelphia might appreciate an all-Pennsylvania Super Bowl. Michael Bradley didn't think Eagles fans were especially excited by that possibility.
Nobody in the state of Pennsylvania likes Philadelphia, except Philadelphia. It would be almost everybody against us here, so which is kind of the way we like it. And Philadelphia fans are so starved for a football championship. They don't care who the opponent is. There's no sentiment involved. It's crush and kill.
Crush and kill. Sounds like football to me. This, on the other hand, doesn't.
The Raiders turned my Sunday dreary, and I pondered, pissed and weary, how my fair Chiefs could wind up on the business end of such a score. But a new faith then came to me, like an arrowhead shot through me. There's no need to feel so gloomy, I grinned. We have what we've yearned for, more than we expected. We're knocking, knocking on that playoff door. Think of that and nothing more.
That's Victor Wishna, author, blogger for Arrowhead Addict and other websites, and Kansas City Chiefs fan. When it turned out his team's opponent would be the Ravens of Edgar Allan Poe's Baltimore, the possibilities seemed to him poetic. Mr. Wishna's derivative verse goes on to predict that the Ravens will return home, quote, bleeding, pleading, nevermore. But he acknowledges that the sentiment may be unrealistic.
I will say, first of all, that in real life, I am not quite as optimistic as the poem would lead one to believe. But I do think that a Chiefs victory at home at Arrowhead is definitely more possible than, say, a talking bird.
Granted, a talking bird, or at least a talking raven, seems unlikely. And so does a winning Seahawk. though Seattle Seahawks head coach Pete Carroll said this week that he is very proud of his team's performance this year, one wonders why. The Seahawks finished the regular season with 7 wins against 9 losses, but because each division winner gets into the playoffs and because the division in which the Seahawks play is filled with bad teams and teams that are worse, Seattle gets to play this afternoon. In preparation for the occasion, numbers cruncher extraordinaire Nate Silver, whose 538 blog appears in the New York Times political section, developed a list of the 10 professional sports teams he considers the worst ever to advance to a postseason. According to Nate Silver's calculations, the Seahawks can claim the distinction of worst NFL team to make the playoffs. When we spoke earlier this week, I asked him for the most compelling bits of evidence to support that contention.
Well, you know, first of all, they did have a losing record at 7-9. Not the only NFL team to do that, but the only other exceptions were in the strike-shortened year of 1982, where the NFL decided we're going to let everyone in the playoffs, pretty much. But for a 7-9 team, they're awfully bad. I mean, the other three teams in their division were also among the worst teams in football. They were beaten by almost a touchdown a game on average. They had the second worst yardage differential in the NFL. They're kind of, you know, they're balanced in the sense that they're bad in almost every conceivable way, right? Their offense ranked 28th out of 32. Their defense was 27th. But this is a team that probably has about 4 and 12 talent that was fortunate or well coached to go 7-9 against kind of weak competition, and you know, and they're 10.5-point underdogs at home, you know, in the NFL playoffs, and that's very unusual.
I think actually my favorite statistic is that in their last 7 games during the regular season, the Seahawks won twice and lost 5 times. It almost seems as if they were trying to avoid the playoffs.
Maybe they can pull off one spectacular upset of the Saints. I mean, stranger things have happened. But, you know, they're not going to reach the Super Bowl, and they're going to draft like 18th or something instead of 9th or 10th, you know. So that makes a big difference, and it didn't really do them any favors necessarily if you're just going to go one and done in the playoffs.
Seattle fans can perhaps take some solace in the fact that this year's Seahawks are not, at least according to you, the worst playoff team ever. Which team captured that distinction?
Well, I think there's one pretty clear front runner if you look at the 4 major sports, which are the 1952-53 Baltimore Bullets of the NBA, who went 16-54. They won about 1/4 of their games, and they made the playoffs because the Philadelphia Warriors went 12-57. They beat the Warriors like 6 times and went 10-50 against the rest of the league. So they were really bad, but you know, the NBA had a very generous playoff structure back then, where all but one team was guaranteed a playoff berth from each division. It's unusual for Seattle to be this bad and make the playoffs. You know, it's usually hard to have the lack of talent, frankly, they have and sneak in. But, you know, I mean, in the NBA and the NHL, it was almost like a separate second season where everyone kind of got in, like a postseason conference tournament in, you know, in a college basketball league where everyone gets a second chance. It was almost kind of the philosophy back then.
As a result of all this rigorous research into losing teams, did you end up with a favorite among 10 lousy postseason teams?
Well, I think the 1949-1950 Sheboygan Redskins of the NBA are kind of a sentimental favorite. The NBA was a very young league back then, and despite that, they basically expanded from, I think, 12 teams to 18, like, overnight. And so the Redskins only had 3 players who had any professional experience at all. You know, nevertheless, they got to the playoffs with a 22-40 record. They beat out, like, you know, them and, like, the Anderson, Indiana Packers and the Waterloo, Iowa Hawks. I mean, these were really obscure teams that didn't survive into later iterations of the NBA. But, you know, a team from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, with a bunch of kids, basically, if they got a little bit lucky, maybe they kind of deserve it. It's kind of a, you know, Hoosiers, the movie story a little bit.
Nate, this list is a bit of an archaeological dig into the way pro sports leagues have changed their playoff formats, isn't it?
You do get to go through different kind of obscure eras in sports history when you kind of put together a list like this. The NHL, for example, had just the original 6 teams for a period of about
30 years. And then when they expanded, they put all six expansion teams, did it all at once, no phasing in like in other sports, and put them in their own league. So an expansion team was guaranteed to be in the Stanley Cup, and four of them were guaranteed to make the playoffs out of six, even though basically the NHL charged you $50,000, which is equivalent to about $200,000 now, anytime you dared to draft a player from one of their rosters. So these were basically minor league teams, and they were guaranteed a matchup against one of the, you know, original six teams, which had their rosters intact pretty much. So just kind of all the quirks of how different sports set up their playoff structures over time is quite fascinating.
Nate, you analyze politics and all kinds of current events and issues on your 538 blog. Did you have more fun compiling this list of really bad playoff teams than you did predicting political races 2 years ago?
You know, it is sometimes more fun to tackle sports topics. I mean, I got my start doing analysis in sports, of baseball in particular. But, you know, one refreshing thing about covering sports is people have fun with it for the most part. You know, I got a few kind of nasty tweets from Seattleites when the column went up, but it's nothing like what you get if you're critical of, you know, Obama or John Boehner, or say so-and-so can't win, or it's nothing like in politics where people get really, really kind of hot under the collar about this stuff. I mean, sports fans are very passionate, but you kind of wake up the next day and you're like, okay, we're not going to look at your worth as a human being any lower because you're a New York Rangers fan instead of a Philadelphia Flyers fan or something, or maybe they do, I don't know.
Your list of 10 worst playoff teams appeared on Monday. You've mentioned that you got some angry tweets from fans of the Seattle Seahawks. I'm wondering if you heard from anybody who said, hey, come on, my team's really lousy. How come you left it off the list?
I didn't hear too much of that. I think a couple people mentioned that the 1981 Kansas City Royals were the only baseball team ever to make the playoffs, the losing record, and there were some people saying, you know, maybe they should have made the list. I think Kansas City doesn't get a lot of recognition for very much of anything, you know, so anything would kind of would help them out a little bit potentially. But for the most part, I don't think people want to have this dubious distinction exactly, you know. I mean, especially in there are some sports like baseball in particular where making the postseason you achieve a goal and it's something meaningful and you kind of, you know, hang a banner from the rafters and so forth. The NFL is a little bit of an outlier where you've had, you know, some 8-8 teams make the playoffs, some pretty bad ones. But the fact that this is kind of the exception to the rule in the NFL, and likewise in baseball, you've had a couple mediocre teams make the playoffs, but really is not all that common an occurrence. Whereas in the NBA and the NHL, you can really be a pretty mediocre team and still make the postseason. Baseball might add another wild card, which is kind of interesting. You know, I think they happened to do well by adding the wild card several years ago, but maybe the balance is pretty good right now. But still, you know, you're not going to have, as you had in the NBA, a 16-54 team make the playoffs, the equivalent thereof in Major League Baseball anytime soon.
Nate Silver is a political polling analyst and a managing partner for Baseball Prospectus. His 538 blog appears in the New York Times political section. To link to his list of the 10 worst playoff teams of all time, visit our website, onlyagame.org. But if you've got a problem with the finalists, take it up with him. Nate, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Picture a tennis match taking place in the middle of Doha Bay in Qatar. Not on an island in the middle of Doha Bay, in the middle of the bay. Now let's up the ante by making it a tennis match between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. In the picture, which you don't have to imagine because you can find it online, two of the game's greatest players face each other across a banner rather than a net on a surface where the ball would splash rather than bounce. Of the promotion, Roger Federer said, it was good fun. It was so different. Rafael Nadal said, it was a very nice experience. So they both know how to play the game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, lift that car, bend that quarter, an old-fashioned strongman contest. But first, between his dominant performances, revelations that his father shopped him in a pay-for-play scheme, and winning the Heisman Trophy, Auburn quarterback Cam Newton has received plenty of media attention. But there's still the BCS National Championship game. Monday night in Glendale, Arizona, Newton and the undefeated Tigers will face the similarly undefeated Oregon Ducks. The Ducks have scored at least 40 points in 10 of their 12 games this season. Joining me now to discuss the title game is George Schroeder, a sports columnist for the Register Guard in Eugene, Oregon. George, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
In your column published on Wednesday, you describe a 9-year-old football fan from Mississippi in the heart of SEC country who professes his love for the Oregon Ducks. You wrote, "The Ducks have captured imaginations all over." What makes the Oregon team such fun to watch?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with children, it might be the mascot that looks like Donald Duck. But, you know, in the case of Seth Smiley, the 9-year-old, it's a fascination with the offense, which moves at this, really fast pace. Some people call it a blur. And these uniforms that change week by week by week. And for I think, older fans, that's a little jarring. I would be one of those people. But I think it's an allure to people across the country, especially younger people.
One of the forces behind Oregon's offensive explosion, what you called the blur, is running back LaMichael James. His worst rushing total of the season is 91 yards, and he's gained over 200 yards twice. Can Auburn's defense slow James down?
Well, I think they've got a shot. That's certainly what they'll try to do, is stop Oregon's running game and LaMichael James. They've got a big front four led by an All-American in Nick Fairley, who's a really good defensive tackle, and I think they'll try to stop the run and see if Oregon can pass the football on them. And nobody has consistently stopped Oregon's running game all year, with the exception of California in the one squeaker Oregon played, and I'm not convinced anybody will do that. I think you can slow them down for a while, but it's hard to stop them for the entire game.
When your Auburn counterpart wins the Heisman Trophy, it is easy to be overshadowed. Tell us a little bit about Ducks quarterback Darren Thomas's performance this season.
Well, he's probably the key to the season. You know, Jeremiah Masoli led the Ducks to the Rose Bowl a year ago, and last winter was suspended for the season and then eventually dismissed from the team for his involvement in a burglary at a frat house. So they went into the season with Darren Thomas and Nate Costa, who was a senior, battling for the job. Thomas is a redshirt sophomore, and he won the job, and here he is. He's been unfazed, and he's actually a playmaker more than he is a caretaker, and he doesn't seem to get rattled by anything, and I think that's been the key to the season. He has played with a confidence and a swagger and an ability that's, frankly, beyond his experience level.
Cam Newton isn't only the Tigers' leading passer, he's also the team's top rusher, so Auburn's offensive game plan is hardly secret. Does Oregon's defense have a trick Auburn's other opponents have missed?
I don't think so. Unless they can deflate the tires on the bus, Cam Newton is going to get a lot of cards and score some points. I mean, he's fantastic. It's funny when I say this, because a year ago we were talking about Tim Tebow being the greatest player of all time, but I have to tell you, Cam Newton has probably had one of the greatest seasons of all time. And when you look at the things he does everything Tim Tebow does better in each category. He's a better passer, more precise. He's a better runner. He's faster. He's at least as powerful. He's more elusive. So I don't know that you're going to see anybody stop him at this level. And now that the NCAA hasn't stopped him, I don't think we'll ever see it happen.
What other aspects of Auburn's game could create problems for Oregon?
Well, they've got good running backs. Their receivers are pretty nice, but it certainly offensively, it all runs through Cam. Defensively, you know, frankly, it's a pretty average defense, and after that front four that we talked about a minute ago, the linebackers and especially the secondary are probably not strengths. So I think Auburn needs Cam Newton to be sort of the Cam Newton we've come to expect him to be in order to hang with Oregon and win the game.
After the allegations about Newton's father shopping him to other schools for money came out, the NCAA briefly suspended Cam Newton and then ruled him eligible to continue playing. In another of your columns this week, you wrote, quote, "The cloud hasn't gone away and it won't." Has the situation tarnished the title game at all for the Ducks and their fans?
I don't think for the Ducks. I have to tell you, I think if Auburn wins, it's going to tarnish it for a lot of people around the country, although apparently not for Auburn fans. We know everyone has agreed, they've stipulated that Cam Newton's father, Cecil, attempted to shop him to Mississippi State. And we could quibble over what the actual numbers were, but north of $100,000 is what he wanted. And then we're asked to believe that not only that Cam Newton didn't know anything about it, that was the big piece of it that allowed the NCAA to reinstate him, was that they couldn't find any evidence that he knew anything about it. We're asked to believe that, which I find hard to believe. And then we're asked to believe that having shopped him for $180,000 or $100,000, he decided to give him to the next school for free. It just strains credulity.
You have written that Oregon's profile has been raised beyond what anyone could have believed by the way they've performed this season. Does this trip to the title game mean the end of Dark Horse, Cinderella, and other underdog storylines out there for the Ducks?
Probably, but there's also the one-hit wonder question would be the next question to ask. Virginia Tech made it to a title game 10 or 11 or 12 years ago and has never been really close to back since. I mean, they've been kind of a consistent top 15 program, but they never made it back. Is Oregon a Virginia Tech, or is it the kind of program that pushes its way into top 5 or top 10 status perennially? I don't know that we know that.
All right, George, it's prediction time, and I apologize in advance for this. Will the Tigers roar, or do the Ducks soar?
Well, I wish you'd ask me tomorrow and then Monday as well, and I might have different answers for you. But since we have to do this, I'm going to say Oregon by a field goal. The Orange Bowl win, and it was in a dominant fashion by Stanford over Virginia Tech, I think should have opened some eyes as to how good Oregon is, because it was down 21-3 to Stanford and won 52-31. And I think that tells you how good Oregon is when Oregon plays well.
George Schroeder is a sports columnist for the Register Guard in Eugene, Oregon. George, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I enjoyed it, Bill.
Last October, the Association of Old-Time Barbell and Strongmen convened at a New Jersey hotel. The colorful annual gathering included champion weightlifters, bodybuilders, and muscle men who performed feats that were popular in the vaudeville era. Only a Game's John Kalish got to meet some of that scene's legends and some of its rising stars.
If you want to rub elbows with a bunch of guys who, for the most part, are still pumping iron into their 70s and 80s, well, this is the place to do it. In a hotel room, muscle-bound men and their admirers are watching a strong man drive a large nail through a frying pan and wooden board using just his hand wrapped in a piece of cloth. 80-year-old Tommy Kono stands next to a giant photo of himself at the age of 28. He has thighs like tree trunks in the picture. Kono was an underweight, frail Japanese-American kid when he discovered weightlifting at an internment camp during World War II.
I got into weight training to improve my health. And one thing led to another, and I ended up being a weightlifter.
Kono set world records in 4 different weight classes, winning 2 gold medals at the Olympics in the 1950s. He still lifts weights today.
I used to say I'm on a maintenance mode. I'm on a survival mode now. People expect me to be in shape, so I can't disappoint them.
The story about sickly kids turning to weightlifting is one you hear over and over again in the world of strong men. Dave Prowse suffered from an arthritic knee as a child, but after a year in the hospital, he got out and started lifting weights.
It took me 9 years to get from being registered as a crippled child to being invited to enter the Mr. Universe contest. And then I was told by the judges that I would never win the competition. And I said, well, why not? They said, well, you've got ugly feet. And I thought, well, I can't do anything about my feet. I kind of train the rest of my body. But I was getting quite strong at the time, so I changed over to competitive weightlifting. And within a year, I became the British heavyweight weightlifting champion.
That was in the early 1960s. Prowse, who is 6'7", went on to a successful acting career. He wore the Darth Vader suit in the first 3 Star Wars movies, though he didn't handle the speaking part. Prowse is an imposing figure, even without his Dark Lord getup. Many of the colorful characters at these gatherings also come from the world of entertainment. Artie Drexler is with the Association of Old Time Barbell and Strongmen.
Many of the guys who are around today are upholding a tradition which is more vaudevillian in nature, where there would always be a strongman at the vaudeville show or a strongman at the circus. They do an incredible variety of things. We have a guy who bends a frying pan and rolls it up, and we have people who break chains, and everyone has their own little specialty that they're prominent at.
Like changing a car tire without tools. That's what Joseph Greenstein did. He was known as the Mighty Adam. Greenstein was just 5'4" and weighed a mere 140 pounds, but is revered by these old-time strongmen. He died in 1977. His son Mike Greenstein, who is 90 years old, still attends these gatherings.
He would put a chain in his mouth and just chew it in half. To me, that was the greatest thing he ever did.
One of the old-timers at the gathering who the Mighty Adam inspired is Lawrence Farman, a strongman known as Slim the Hammerman because he does his act with a pair of chrome sledgehammers. Sledgehammers, it turns out, were a big part of his day job.
I cut stone for 50 years. I broke 10 tons of stone an hour, boulders, and I did it for 10 and 12 hours a day.
Farman met the Mighty Adam when he was 8 years old and watched the legendary strongman's act at a farmer's market in Gilbertsville, Pennsylvania. Many years later, the Mighty Adam laid down a challenge to Farman, who had grown to 6'6" and was strong as an ox.
He said, "How is it only I, an old man among you, am the only one that can bend this spike?" And he said, "Can you bend this spike?" I said, "If you can, and I damn sure can." And he said, "Come to me." And I get up here in front of all these people. And I took that thing and boom, goes it right up like that there. And he said he'd never seen nothing like it in his life.
Such bravado is common in the strongman scene. A New Jersey strongman who uses the stage name Stanless Steel reportedly has had trucks weighing more than 10,000 pounds driven onto him. But the 270-pound vegetarian considers his greatest feat to be one involving a 25-cent piece.
Definitely the most difficult thing in my whole life that I've ever done was bend a quarter. And I don't believe until I see it, man to man, anyone else that could ever do it in the whole entire world.
The man who is said to be pound for pound the strongest man in the world is Dennis Rogers, who weighs less than 170 pounds. The 54-year-old strongman is an ordained Christian minister with a shaved head and an earring. He does 200 shows a year at everything from corporate retreats to rock concerts. Rogers has won the U.S. and World Arm Wrestling Championships, and his feats include breaking official police handcuffs and tearing thick phone books vertically. Rogers has stopped two Air Force fighter planes from taking off and four Harley Davidsons from moving.
I believe that I'm blessed with strength. I believe I have a gift just like someone who is a great singer, or you might remember somebody when you're in first grade or something, and you look over and see some kid drawing this fantastic picture. And I remember doing that, and I remember saying, "Who taught you how to do that?" And he goes, "I don't know," like that, you know. And that's the way my strength was. I believe that it was there all along. I just hadn't tapped into it because of my mind, because I believed I was weak.
Roger says his act is so draining that he only works out with weights 20 times a year. He's likely to have even less time to work out in the months ahead. Rogers recently signed a deal to do a reality TV series. When I left the hotel where the strongman gathering was held, he was hanging out in the lobby at 2 in the morning with guys who were bending all sorts of steel objects. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in Newark, New Jersey.
Working hard to be the best, working out to be the best, and a strong man of the world. Who will it be? Will be the one. Who's the strongest of the strong, the champion of the world? They got some glory. This is their story.
You're listening to Only a Game. When Christmas and New Year's Day fall on Saturday, we wonder how many of our listeners will find something to do other than listen to Only a Game on those particular days. Perhaps we needn't have been concerned. An email in rhyme from Tom Nielsen, a WBUR listener, read, "Year after year, one thing stays the same, listening to Bill and it's only a game. The first thing I did in 2011 was listen to Littlefield at 7. Tom Cuffell, who's in the U.S. Army, sent this message, which was marked unclassified. "I just read Mr. Littlefield's Christmas jingle and his other posts. Can it be there is someone in the world who has found a job that he enjoys and is so secure in his knowledge of it that he can toy with it? Please tell him how fortunate he is." Message received, sir, and thank you. From Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, Isaac Lynn emailed with a correction after he had listened to my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week. If Charlie was referring to the Calgary Flames when he said there is an outdoor hockey game each year in Calgary, he is mistaken. The only official outdoor NHL games were the Heritage Classic in 2003, held in Edmonton, and the Winter Classics of the past four New Year's Days. B.J. Entwistle, who hears the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, was dismayed to hear Charlie admit that he'd only watched the last 12 or 13 minutes of the women's basketball game between Stanford and the University of Connecticut. "Why do you put up with this?" he wrote. Well, in part because those 12 or 13 minutes constituted 12 or 13 more minutes than a lot of sports writers and columnists watched. My midweek commentary mentioned the concerns some pro football players have about the potential consequences of concussions, an occupational hazard in their work. Dev Luthrow responded to that commentary through onlyagame.org. "Watching football is ever a guilty pleasure for me," he wrote. "I remember reading an article in Sports Illustrated on the occupational injuries and their aftermath, a horrific read, but here I am, still watching." If the station that brings you Only a Game doesn't also bring you the midweek commentaries, you can get them as a podcast each Thursday, or you can read them at onlyagame.org. You can reach us through that portal as well, or leave a message on the listener line, 617-353-1860. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com. This is NPR.
Early next month, the Chinese calendar will initiate the Year of the Rabbit, sometimes called the Year of the Hare. In an aquarium in Seoul, South Korea, several scuba divers decided to celebrate early. They dressed up as rabbits, complete with bunny ears, and went diving. This method of celebration brings up several questions. How well do rabbits swim, for example? And how much would rabbits want to swim? And if they were compelled to swim, say to get away from a tiger in the Year of the Tiger, which we're currently experiencing, what sort of chance would they have? And then there's the matter of what would happen to the divers in the Year of the Rock. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, an appreciation of an especially decorated and durable soccer player. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
How do you decorate a soccer player?
Well, it's simple. You hang medals around her neck until she can no longer hold up her head. With the NFL playoffs upon us, we should talk about the fact that the rules have changed, and this time I'm not talking about late hits and headhunting, but about what will transpire if two teams are tied at the end of the game. What happens then?
All kinds of stuff that I don't pretend to understand. All I do know is you can't win now in overtime just by going down 25 yards and kicking a field goal. Other stuff happens after that.
As for what that is, stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
So get this straight. We're hoping for a tie so that this plays out and we all learn how it happens.
All right. You asked for it. Okay, so anyway, they can't win. They can't win on a first possession field goal. That can't happen, okay? If both teams kick field goals on their first possessions, the next team to score wins. Apparently, score of any nature wins the game. If one team kicks a field goal and the other team does it on the first possession, then the game's over. And any touchdown wins the game at any time, period. Maybe.
I'm glad we cleared that up.
I think we're going to have to take these out for a test drive.
The New York Jets play Indianapolis this evening. The team is also facing lawsuits by two massage therapists based on the behavior of Brett Favre when he was in the Jets' employ. And then there's that $100,000 fine because their strength coach tripped an opposing player as he went running by. So why is Jets coach Rex Ryan spending his time questioning the skills of Patriots quarterback Tom Brady?
Well, because he's been presiding over a circus for the entire season. He's jealous of some of the other clowns at this point. I don't know. He praised Peyton Manning and needled Tom Brady at about the same time, saying that, you know, Brady gets more help from Bill Belichick than Peyton Manning does from Jim Caldwell. Rex Ryan is a lot of fun for New York newspapers. His abilities to run a franchise are still pretty much under question, I think.
College football's championship game takes place on Monday. Auburn arrived to much fanfare on a 400-seat chartered airliner filled with players and fans. And the
Boosters.
Players have already been spotted at Scottsdale area nightclubs, which will surprise everybody. Meanwhile, Oregon arrived quietly and the players have been given a curfew. So does this in any way indicate who's going to win the game on Monday?
No, it doesn't at all, but it does indicate what a complete farce college sports is. Again!
Michigan head coach Rich Rodriguez was not fired last year when his program was disciplined by the NCAA for practice and training violations. He was fired this week after Michigan lost in the Gator Bowl by 38 points. So there's a lesson in there somewhere, I guess.
Don't lose.
By 38 points.
Don't lose by 3 points, but especially don't lose by 38 points.
Most likely, Stanford quarterback Andrew Luck would have been the number one pick in the NFL draft had he chosen to make himself available, but he announced this week that he will return to Stanford instead. Hopefully, he'll have a lucky year without any injuries. Get it?
Yes.
Lucky?
Very nice. I saw what you did there. What a thing.
Yeah, football.
This is a nice story for everyone, and I hope to heaven that Andrew Luck has a really good insurance agent.
Apparently, Charlie, billboards have sprung up in Columbus, Ohio, congratulating TCU on its Rose Bowl win over Wisconsin. So, TCU, that's in Texas. Wisconsin, that's in Wisconsin. Who's running billboards in Ohio?
TCU people who remember that Ohio State referred to college football teams like TCU as playing, quote, the Little Sisters of the Poor. Sooner or later, the Little Sisters of the Poor are going to get really angry and start beating people up for being like the metaphor of choice for weakness in all sports. I can hardly wait for this attack of the nuns on every sports writer in America.
One of your favorite institutions,
yeah!
The Baseball Hall of Fame, will induct two new members in the spring, Bert Blyleven and Roberto Alomar. Good additions?
You know, the people who take this thing seriously, the fools, tell me they are. So I say they are. I was kind of intrigued by what else happened on the bat. Barry Larkin came very close, which sort of surprises me, actually. I hadn't given Barry Larkin a minute of thought since he left baseball. And, of course, Jess Bagwell was held down because people are waxing philosophical about the possibility of steroid-era players getting into the Hall of Fame, which I've heard it explained as, we're going to keep all these guys we suspect. We have no proof, mind you. We suspect. We're going to keep them out until we develop a standard, but we're not sure if we're ever going to develop a standard.
Or what it will be.
This is why this whole thing should be taken away from these people and handed over to the first 25 people you meet sleeping on steam grates outside the Boston Public Library.
After one of several recent Lakers losses, head coach Phil Jackson said, and I'm quoting now, "We get behind early in the third quarter on some stupid plays, and then Kobe has to screw up the game." Was a clarification forthcoming, or are the Lakers trying to get rid of Kobe Bryant?
I have no idea. I know Phil Jackson is trying to get rid of his quote. He said, I use that term screw it up, not in terms of it being an error or a mistake, but crank it up. What?
No.
What is he talking about?
Screwed up means screwed up.
Screwed up means you made a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, like getting involved with voting for the Hall of Fame.
That's kind of what I thought. WNBA star Diana Taurasi has been tossed off the team for which she was playing in Turkey. She failed a drug test. Taurasi had signed a multi-year contract with the WNBA, and of course she was expected to play in her third Olympics in 2012. Do you think either of these institutions will be forgiving?
I don't know. It's a very interesting question. It depends on how hard the international doping police lean on the American governing bodies, I would think.
Charlie, last week, Ted Williams was a homeless guy with a great voice.
I thought he was a dead slugger. Hey,
this is a different Ted Williams, and you know that as well as I do. And
does
this
he have a head?
He's... In any case,
yes,
Ted Williams, the latter, has been offered an announcing job with the Cavaliers, and the team has offered to buy him a house. You think they'll just give him LeBron's old place?
This guy, I mean, everybody's seen this by now, so we're way behind the curve on this, YouTube being YouTube. This is the guy from the homeless guy in Columbus, Ohio, with the absolutely amazing pipes, who seems to have been born, you know, to the people who do movie trailers.
Mm-hmm.
I think this guy very well may be the next John Facenda. If this guy's not working for NFL Films within 3 years, I'll be amazed.
In an attempt to take attention away from allegations that the latest round of World Cup bidding was less than completely honest,
no!
This week FIFA President Sepp Blatter lashed out at the International Olympic Committee's financial practices. He said that organization handles money, quote, like a housewife. I just can't imagine that this is going to make things better for Mr. Blatter.
Well, I wonder how Mrs. Sepp Blatter, who already has enough problems being named that, having married into it, feels about this. Yes, the IOC, but then again, the FIFA handles money like a housewife who engages in international bribery and deceit. So what's the difference?
It's a busy housewife.
It is.
This week, Mikhail Zislas, the media officer for the Russian team that won gold at the World Junior Hockey Championship, said, I cannot sleep because everybody in Russia is calling me, asking me what's going on. What was going on?
Well, the Russian junior hockey team won a great game against Canada. They scored 5 unanswered goals to beat the Canadians 5-3. And then, you know what it was, as we say around Kiev, party! Da-da-da! And they partied so hardy, they got thrown off their plane and were stuck in Buffalo.
And finally, Charlie, lots of people thought the television special with which LeBron James announced that he was leaving the Cleveland Cavaliers was over the top, and it appears that King James has learned to tone down his celebrations. Describe for us, please, LeBron's birthday cake.
He has a birthday cake that looks very much like the Stanley Cup, except it goes all the way except it goes all the way to the ceiling.
And it's multicolored.
How much of this
and it has crowns
yeah,
on it.
Chris, how much of this gold cake is actually edible? I mean, you get lead poisoning eating this thing.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, and what an idiot cake that is. Various other books as well. He joins me each week on All the E-Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you'd like to see the picture of LeBron's birthday cake, tweeted by the king himself, visit our website, onlyagame.org, and maybe you'll have some leftovers there in the fridge. This week, Christine Lilly, who made her first appearance on the U.S. women's soccer team at the age of 16 in 1987, announced her retirement. Though she was among the women training for this year's World Cup in Germany, Lilly said this week that though the reasoning was hard to explain, she knew the time had come to step away from competitive soccer.
It's almost like falling in love when you want to spend the rest of your life with someone. You can't really explain it. You just know you're going to, you know, this is the time to get married. And it was just the time to retire.
Some of Christine Lilly's achievements as a soccer player seem incomprehensible. The most durable, determined, and productive male and female players can aspire to perhaps 100 appearances with their national teams. Christine Lilly has played in 352 games for the U.S. She is the youngest player to have scored a goal for that team. She is also the oldest. She has played in 5 FIFA World Cups and 3 Olympics. She's helped her teams win 4 of those tournaments, finish 2nd twice and 3rd 3 times. She's earned All-Star and/or All-League mention during each of her 5 years with the Boston Breakers in the WUSA and then the WPS. And beyond all that, Christine Lilly has represented her sport with energy, grace, and unfailing good humor. In retirement, she will be raising daughter Sydney, now 2, running soccer camps with former teammates Mia Hamm and Trish Venturini, and perhaps writing a book. But maybe there will also be time for that group retirement party that's been on hold while Christine Lilly continued to play. Years ago, Doug Merlino, a white, not especially athletic eighth grader attending a selective private school in Seattle, joined an AAU basketball team that was also a modest sort of social experiment. In retrospect, Merlino has acknowledged that he was, quote, on the team for racial balance. For his first book, titled The Hustle, Merlino sought out his former teammates, black and white, in an attempt to discover what they were doing today and what, if anything, that 1986 social experiment had achieved. In a recent conversation, the author told me that he and his teammates were not entirely aware that their black coach, Willie McLean, the man who assembled the team, had goals beyond basketball.
It wasn't made explicit to us at the time, but we knew, having two sides, one coming from mainly the suburbs and white enclaves of Seattle, another coming from central Seattle, which was primarily black at that point. I mean, we knew that this was not a normal basketball team and that there were some greater goals. We were never really sat down and told, this is so you can all be friends and cross racial lines. But just by the setup, it was pretty obvious that something was up.
Doug Merlino doesn't remember how many times his basketball team won, but he told me that he'll never forget one particular ride home from a road game. He had to give the coach directions, and as the team van wound through suburban streets lined with what Merlino calls McMansions, he realized that his black teammates had never been in a neighborhood like his. At least one of them was baffled by the size of the Merlino family manse.
One of my teammates, Damien, asked me, what side do you live on? And I had no idea what he was talking about for a second. And, I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, what side? Do you live on the right side or the left side? And I realized he thought it was an apartment building. I said, you know, it's one house. And all these guys were just looking at me. And, of course, I scrambled out of this van as quickly as I could and into the house.
Doug Merlino, who became a journalist and now lives in New York City, began trying to reconnect with his former teammates in 2002. Some of them were easy to find. Dino Christofilos had become a multimillionaire as a result of the success of the hedge fund he had started. Sean O'Donnell had become a prosecutor in Seattle. Both men are white. Merlino found it was more difficult to locate some of his black former teammates. One of them, Terrell Johnson, had been murdered, perhaps as a consequence of what Merlino terms Johnson's, quote, peripheral involvement with drugs. Another didn't seem to have a fixed address.
John Thompson, or as we call him, JT, had been a very popular, gentle kid. And when I'd come back, the word on him was that he was on the streets and involved in some type of hustling, and no one kind of knew what he was up to. And, you know, he basically told me, like, that team was a family, and I loved you guys. And, I mean, he was still involved in various street hustles, but he really wanted to talk. And, of course, the one other guy was Myron, who had a cocaine addiction for years, and at the start, me and another guy run into him on the streets, which was very uncomfortable, and then several years later, he was arrested and in jail, and that's when our conversations really started.
One of Doug Merlino's conclusions in The Hustle is that despite well-meaning coaches and some private schools that tried, albeit sometimes wrong-headedly, to reach out to minority students, most of his black teammates were doomed to struggle. As he puts it, they had very little margin for error. The disadvantages of poverty were overwhelming. He points out that when Lakeside, the private school he attended, tried to address the social divide in Seattle by recruiting minority faculty, 5 of the 6 new hires left the school after 1 year. But Merlino's work on the book did result in at least one reconnection with a black former teammate. As the author puts it, Damian Joseph, the guy who'd asked him which half of the house his family lived in, became a role model. He's a teacher now and active in his church.
Damian Joseph and I have a rapport and we have the same interests. And so I hope and I think our friendship is going to continue because we spent so much time talking, and I think that we've both really come to know each other on a much deeper level. And I think we have both say that that's the level that as kids we never got to. We did play basketball, we did have some fun, but, you know, as men, you can go that step beyond.
As sociological study, The Hustle is flawed for all sorts of reasons, beginning with the size of the sample. as the story of one young basketball player who became a writer curious enough to look up the guys with whom he had played, in part, it's a discouraging commentary. Late in the book, Doug Merlino refers to Jackie Robinson, saying of him that the transcendent Dodger recognized that, quote, celebrating people on the athletic fields can be a substitute for real equality. Our team, Merlino writes, was never going to do more than paper over the rift. To the extent that he has acknowledged that rift and begun to build authentic connections with some of his former teammates on the other side of it, Doug Merlino has made an admirable start. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Chris Thayer, Paul Vikas, and Doug Patterson at KUOW in Seattle. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived chosen stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Philadelphia Magazine columnist Michael Bradley.
Well, everybody knows that the Eagles fans are very welcoming and are so, so kind to opponents and their fans.
Wait a minute. These are the fans who snowballed Santa Claus, right? Just checking. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.